You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 3rd of February, 2021. This should not surprise you. The topic I'm going to deal with today, I've been dealing for most of my career. It's a country that is almost entirely unknown. Even educated people couldn't find it on a map or understand its significance. Some of you have heard that the military in Burma has, at least in part, taken over the government yet again. For 2 decades, I've been defending the military government and its various incarnations, and challenging the myths about it. Many of you may wonder why, if for all these years, I made a big deal about this country as a flashpoint in international affairs. Back in 2009, I believe it was 2009 or 10, I did my first broadcast on this topic. And I'll repeat exactly why it is so significant. CIA, first of all, sees Burma as essential. George Soros and the regime as a whole has a explicit Burma project aimed against China. Drugs are a huge part of this. The opposition to the military government is driven by ethnic civil wars, as well as the Burmese Communist Party. And they largely monopolize the drug trade. Much of the opium coming through Central Asia and into Russia, if not coming through Afghanistan and Kosovo, goes in the other direction. And Burma is a major transit point. Mossad and CIA both have a huge presence in the country. So the regime has a great interest because on the one hand, they want to get their hands on this poppy crop. And of course, making that legal in America can monopolize and dominate that market. You should be thinking of the opium wars. Again, this is no coincidence. Thirdly, China views Burma as critical to its economic life. China has largely colonized the northern part of the country and has spent quite a bit of money in modernizing its infrastructure. We've spoken about the possibility of a war between India and China. Burma is going to be one of its main theaters. The Chinese have built, especially naval bases in the area, in the Bay of Bengal. And India has been worried about this. This is one of the reasons that India has tilted ever so slightly to the United States. Fourthly, and I've said this many times, the Burmese military government, starting in the early 1960s, is an explicitly national socialist system. That's not something that I'm projecting onto it. That's what they called themselves. Their manifesto from 1962 is called The Burmese Way to Socialism. And it is one of the purest expressions of Asian national socialism imaginable. It's socialism in the sense that it's an ideal understanding of connecting labor to value to reward in a social context. But that social context, of course, is based around tradition, agrarianism, and independence. Burma is also important because it has one of the most powerful militaries in Southeast Asia. It's a member of ASEAN. And now the major banks of the world view Burma as a threat. Because they have a state-controlled central bank, the internationalist and globalist institutions have been removed from the country. So you have a desire for both the CIA and China to colonize Burma, although, frankly, the Chinese have long since won that. The so-called democracy movement is purely the creation of the regime of neoliberalism and the West. This is absolutely essential to understanding not just international politics, but Southeast Asia in particular, and the coming war with China. The fallen hero of the university liberals, many of you have heard her. She won the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize for some reason, Aung San Suu Kyi. She was overthrown on February 1st of 2021. When I first got into this area, the whole thing got started because several TV shows and even music videos, which were popular at the time, mentioned her and the so-called democracy movement there. Whenever anything is called a democracy movement, the regime is deliberately being vague. Now, keep her older brother is an American citizen. She was very early picked by the Western elite to secure Burma's alliance with the regime. Of course, like all of these color revolution pictures I mentioned over the last 2 weeks, she was educated in the West, both Oxford and University of London. Then she took a job at the UN. In fact, I have a copy of her ID badge. But even when she was in school, or finishing school, her husband was dying in Burma, and for some reason both the United Nations and the papacy intervened to allow her back in the country. Why the papacy somehow found this interesting is a separate issue. But her elite status is one of the clearest elements of this. The last 2 weeks we've talked about the men themselves. She's the only woman. The men themselves who the regime has put forward as leaders of their color revolutions. Guaido in Venezuela. We've mentioned the guys in Kyrgyzstan and Thailand, whose names I can't think of off the top of my head. Shashkavili in Georgia. Pashinyan in Armenia. Navalny in Russia. We can go on and on and on. The woman in Belarus, again, whose name is insignificant. They all have a lot in common. The last 10 years, she's won every possible award. The Global Citizens Award from the Atlantic Council, the National Endowment for Democracy, has been financing her entire career. They gave her the 2012 Democracy Award, and she's regularly briefing the Council on Foreign Relations about the situation in that country. She was installed as a state counselor, allegedly the chief executive of Burma, some people call it Myanmar, not too long ago. The reason they had to invent this executive, state counselor, is that because she's a felon, because she is a dual citizen, she can't hold office, so the regime had to invent one. So, there was an election in November. The election was contested. what shouldn't surprise you is that the methods by which it was contested are identical to what we've been talking about as far as the American fraud. The military and the military-aligned parties claimed that the entire thing was set up by the West to disenfranchise millions of voters. These elections are largely financed by, among other places, the National Endowment for Democracy. 2003-2004, the NED gave over $3 million in the foreign operations legislation in building democracy. I have not been able to find out if Dominion ran the voting machines or if they used machines at all. They've mobilized the refugees from the civil wars that have been going on there for a long time. The military party is called the Union Solidarity and Development Party, USDP. But Key's party allegedly won 396 out of 476 seats in both upper and lower house of the parliament. If this were a real result, the military would have been effectively sidelined from legislation. The army and those aligned with it have cited, as of this talk, 10.5 million cases involving irregularities of every possible type. The Burma Election Commission, which is entirely staffed by the West and by Key's people, vehemently denies this, of course, even using the same rhetoric as the U.S. system. Now, the chief executive position is held by Min Aung Hlaing. But prior to, Key was installed in 2011, the military had run the country from 1962 to 2011 in various guises. And I've mentioned the National Endowment for Democracy before, and I do make it a point to research the members of the board, which is often very telling. As of a few years ago, just a few people of interest: John Bohn, who was in the petrochemical industry, a banker with Wells Fargo, and runs Global Net Partners. The point of that is to have American businesses penetrate the Chinese market. Rita DiMartino was at AT&T. Kenneth Duberstein was from Boeing. Also ConocoPhillips. Even Fannie Mae until 2007. The regime intellectuals like Francis Fukuyama and Vin Weber. Moses Naim from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Larry Liebenow from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Anne Marie Slaughter, who's one of the directors of Citigroup and McDonald's. And former Congressman Richard Gephardt. And I mentioned him because I've said many times how the government and the private sector are essentially a revolving door. After Gephardt was a Democratic congressman from Missouri, after his retirement, he went to work as a lobbyist for Boeing, Goldman Sachs, Visa, and Waste Management Incorporated. He's also a lobbyist for the Ford Motor Company. These guys have the money to hire former congressmen to do their lobbying, because who knows more than they do about how things operate? You guys get the picture. Aung San Suu Kyi, I've spoken about her at great length. Her entire family is extremely wealthy, is elite, of course, English-speaking. And as always, media manipulation is at the forefront. And we can go on and on as far as her power. I want to quote from Niles Bowie, who's one of the few people dealing with this issue. Here's what he says about it. And he's talking about the tactics of the regime here, financing the her party. The tactics condone the funding of ethnic minority groups, which in reality are warring ethnic insurgency groups who have profited immensely from narcotics trafficking. In the heroin production region of the Golden Triangle. During the 2007 Saffron Revolution, dissident religious leaders echoed indications of such training, provided by Khalifa and his team sticking to scripted U.S. foreign policy objectives. Slogans like, we want national reconciliation, we want dialogue with the military, we want freedom for Aung San Suu Kyi. The global media has created the impression this uprising is a pro-democracy protest against political oppression. Silence is paid to the fact that those marches are totally economic in nature, taking place after the government lifted fuel subsidies at the request of the IMF, resulting in unannounced fuel price increases up to 500%. After similar demonstrations were held in Indonesia for the same reason, Western governments championed the country for getting in line with market prices. The Western media portrayed the 8888 uprising of 1988 as exclusively caused by the public outcry for democracy, when the protest came to fruition because General Ne Win suddenly demonetized 75% of the country's currency into worthless paper and issued banknotes of odd denominations like 45 and 90, which is odd because they were based on a superstitious inclination for the number 9 and its divisibles to bring good fortune. That's a mouthful. It's true that near the end of the military government, they began to liberalize, bringing in the IMF, and in some cases, hopefully relieving some of the sanctions. So as it stands now, Aung San Suu Kyi is now on house arrest. No one has been harmed. And the president, Win Myint, and the National League for Democracy, which is the NLD, which is her party, all under house arrest right now. So they've said recently, we remain calm as long as we're provided with everything. There's a shop and a cafe, we have a place to eat, but the territory of the hotel is isolated from the outside world. We're not ready to say anything, nothing public yet. So they are being treated well. This isn't your typical military coup in that sense. Myint Swe, who is the vice president, who is now appointed as acting president by the army, said that the military takeover is fully in line with the Constitution, which, of course, it is. You have mass protests against voter fraud that have begun in many regions of the country, and the state of emergency has been, or more or less martial law, has been erected in accordance with Articles 417 and 418 of the Constitution. So, there was, rumors that Donald Trump was going to declare martial law. Burma actually went and did it. So the military takeover is about stopping this fraudulent election and declaring a state of emergency, because not only, of course, you have these long-standing civil wars, which, go up and down in intensity over the years, but now you have protests all over the country aimed at the CIA and Suu Kyi. The writers that I've just quoted echo what I've been saying for a long time. Anytime you hear the phrase pro-democracy, understand that it's a deliberate mystification. We've been through this before. The concept of democracy has no functional meaning, just like racism and all this stuff. These words are meant as weapons, not as promoters of information. You go to the State Department website, there are democracy sub-offices, and it's very hard to find any functional definition. They use the word almost every paragraph, but it's very hard to find an explicit definition that covers all the uses of the term. But if you take all the uses of the term and put them together, you realize that the word does not refer to elections. It can, but it doesn't. Democracy, as I've said before, is the same as liberalism. It's liberal ideology, and all of its factions, left liberalism, disguised as democracy. That's what the regime means when it uses that word. I think the very first time I came across the word being misused, it was in during the Yugoslav breakup. A few years after that, the New York Times headline said, "Serbian radicals win by huge margins in Serbian elections, democracy endangered." I've quoted that many times before. That was the very first time I've seen this mockery of use of the word. The State Department does say this, though. They say, "Supporting democracy not only promotes such fundamental American values as religious freedom and workers' rights, but also helps create a more secure, stable, and prosperous global arena in which the United States can advance its national interests." So if you were to summarize all the uses of the word democracy in these cases, especially as far as the color revolution is concerned, you have capitalism, you have the destruction of state-owned industries, you have liberalism in all of its senses, freedom of speech only for leftists, the shutdown of any dissenting institutions, pushing the military far outside of politics, destroying every right-wing party, no matter how popular they might be, breaking down the state-centered economy, kicking the state out of currency and finance, ease of divorce, easy abortion, feminism, the destruction of the family, the rule of the alienated individual over everything rather than, of course, natural institutions like the family. It is not a coincidence that this occurs precisely as the Western world is now fully aware of the vote fraud in the United States. I've been through this many times. I have an entire broadcast where I try to summarize the evidence. It's so overwhelming and almost overpowering that it's really hard to summarize. And just like in, you know, there's no rational way to defend these elections. This is the case in where all the color revolutions are, and of course Biden was just a color revolution. And Biden is very much like the people that I've been talking about. I think Joe Biden is a little different in that there really is no such person. Joe Biden doesn't know where he is most of the time. And they're blatant about this. I mean, at least most of these other people that I've mentioned, they're coherent. They could put out policy, sometimes in a very disjointed kind of a way. But you notice in the American case, there's not even an attempt to defend this ridiculous election. But that is fully appropriate in their definition of what democracy is. Putting it short, any victory for the left in any of its factions, any of its guises, is democratic. And I think this is very, you know, there's not a coincidence that the same thing went for overtly Marxist and Leninist countries. Democracy was the rule of the party. A proletarian is someone who supported Marxism. In my book on the Soviet Union, the Soviet experiment, I say, and actually give a lot of evidence, that Lenin and Trotsky will take someone like Armand Hammer, a multi-billionaire by today's standards, and consider him a proletarian. But a poverty-stricken Ukrainian priest would be considered a capitalist. That's how those terms were used. It's absolutely essential for you guys to realize that the regime doesn't use words the same way everyone else does. That's been a huge part of its scam. It's a way to confuse. It's a way to alter people's conduct, because, you know, if language is at least in part constitutive of reality, and certainly in the postmodern world it is reality, then whoever controls language controls the world. But the reason this is so significant is the war coming with Russia, China, or both. We talked about Armenia. We spoke of the coming war with Iran. Navalny in Russia. And in this case now, the Chinese. Burma is a key ally of China. Remember how large this country is. Burma is sitting on a lot of oil. It's sitting on natural gas. It's sitting on some of the most fertile soil, volcanic soil in Asia. And it's sitting on trillions of dollars worth of gems. The place has the potential of being extremely wealthy. One of the things that the color revolutions around the world have done, and almost all of them have this in common, it was to ensure that the nations involved, that more or less had been run by military or nationalist governments of one type or another, never reached first world status. This is something that doesn't get mentioned very much. I was the first person to mention any of this. But all of these countries, I mean, even to some extent, Yugoslavia, but Libya, Syria, Iraq, I mean, Armenia was always first world. Iran's always first world and growing even more powerfully. These countries, had nothing happened, had they been allowed to develop normally, would be economic powerhouses today. They would be altering the nature of global politics right now. Now, Burma is not at that level yet, but its economic growth was suggesting that it was. And China was essential here. Some of the projects that the regime is trying to dismantle by installing this movement in power that the military has just overthrown, some of these projects include the China Harbor Engineering Company, which is a subsidiary of the China Communications Construction Company. $1.4 billion project connecting both Burma and Sri Lanka. Chinese have invested heavily in Sri Lanka as a counterweight to India in union with Burma. Pakistan, Burma, Sri Lanka, China is the number one source of investment. And we'll talk about the Belt and Road here in a minute. But if there's one thing that threatens the regime, it is that Belt and Road. Now, the military party that allegedly lost these elections is the USDP, as I mentioned before. Their policy, their platform is typical NS, maintaining the Burmese Union as one functional nation. Of course, the regime is trying to split it apart. While the market economy is practiced, capitalism is rejected. They explicitly say that their foreign policy is independent and proactive. Military spending will continue to increase. Ethnic unity is very important. One of the things that the military government was absolutely obsessed with and is connected to their infrastructure projects and educational system is trying to wed the small ethnic groups into an actual functional Burmese nation. And they were going to do this by building the economic infrastructure that connected it. They're too small to create functional states. But remember, Burma is a union. And one of the big debates is how centralized or how decentralized it should be. when you're under attack, when you're fighting ethnic civil wars fueled by drug money in the West, centralization is something that you don't, you know, you have no choice. You have to promote it. The right to the peasantry to their land, something the military government has been involved with for a very long time. The rights of labor. Religious freedom, of course, because it's a multi-religious society. The building of syndicates and cooperative institutions. The military government has brought Burma to a very high level of literacy. And that healthcare is based on physical fitness, creating strong men. And of course, as always, that the cultural policy is to build a Burmese nation. Which I know was a tall order. It's like trying to build a Yugoslav nation or a Nigerian nation. I have argued against these sort of things in the past. But in this particular case, since these nations are, these smaller nations are under Western control to a great extent, and they're being fueled by drug money, whether these are actual self-determination movements or not is certainly up in the air. But once the military took over again in 1988, the first thing they did was bring the Chinese in. I should also note that under military rule, there were 42 registered political parties. And there's two big ones that support the army. Those are not CIA creations. You may notice that when you look at some of these demonstrations over the last few years, especially in the South, the so-called Rohingya crisis, which I've dealt with elsewhere, most of the signs are in English. In fact, I've seen signs, whether it be in Bangladesh or Myanmar or Sri Lanka, where all the signs are in English. So the military took over, whether it be in the 60s or in the 80s. Their rationale was to crush the ethnic insurgencies, and number two, to smash the drug trade, but those things are really one and the same. And as always, number three, the more liberal democratic governments had completely mismanaged the economy. And a lot of it had to do with keeping the Chinese at arm's length. Now, when Suu Kyi was installed, she realized that if she didn't cooperate with the army, these drug lords, the so-called Rohingya movement, would have crushed all attempts to restore law and order to these areas. With that make-believe crisis in the South, all of a sudden, Suu Kyi was under a regime attack. In fact, she came out and defended military policy in the area, and even blamed the West for funding all of this. That is something that they did not expect. It's one of the things that makes her relatively unique in the color revolution world. There was even talk of cutting her off, of reimposing sanctions, including on her. All of a sudden, if you guys remember, all the mythology that Buddhism is this peace-loving religion was thrown out the window. The famous Time magazine cover of the Buddhist monk, who they call the fascist and all the typical names, he was defending his people in the Rakhine state in southern Burma. Suddenly, you know, it was on the cover not just of Time, but everywhere. All of a sudden, the regime's love affair with Buddhism falls off. Exclusively because they were arming themselves against the U.S. proxy forces. But the military government, despite all the mythology, has been fairly successful. From 1988, Burma has grown on average roughly of 6% per year, despite sanctions, despite civil war, and despite war with these drug lords. So this 6% growth has occurred in the harshest of circumstances. And they play, like so many of these, like even Bashir Assad, played with some form of liberalization for the sake of getting some liquidity, which went nowhere. But they realized that a certain level of openness was necessary. But even now, that's no longer the case. That was a long time ago. Openness meaning liberalization for the West, doesn't matter. As I've said many times before, whether it be Ukraine or Armenia or Burma, they do not create, produce anything that the West actually needs. Well, except drugs in the Burmese case. While inflation has been a problem, its economic performance is, under these circumstances, been fairly impressive. But heavy investment, Chinese assistance, and their connection with the Eurasian market is absolutely essential. The military government was representative, especially when it came to land ownership, infrastructure, and the creation of industrial jobs. But let's be clear here. In the 1990s, poppy production was down over 75% only in areas that the Burmese military controlled. The UN said the exact same thing about the Taliban. They almost completely eradicated the poppy trade in both cases. But also in both cases, due to Johnson's law, the regime claimed that these governments were supporting the drug trade. Both the Taliban and the Burmese military have destroyed millions of tons of opium and other narcotics grown by CIA stooges. Just for one example, one of the main opposition forces militarily is the Shan United Army. This is almost certainly a CIA military front, and they control a substantial amount of the heroin trade in the country. When the military, prior to all this nonsense, put a major general in charge of the main central bank, Soros went ballistic. Because of this, this is what happens when you have to centralize a country under extreme difficulty. All the resources of the nation have to be under the only functioning entity in the nation, and that is the army. The military have to control the state because of the drug trade and because of the constant warfare. There is complete freedom of speech in Burma. The military simply isn't large enough to control this huge country. As I've said, there's over 40 political parties. The only thing that the military will crack down on is a drug trade and explicit ethnic separatism. But most of these parties are ethnic separatist parties. Russia's done the same, banning regionally based parties. There's no regionally based parties in the U.S., for example. And it's something that the army is going to worry about. For example, under British colonialism, about half the economy was controlled by foreigners. I mentioned the opium trade, the opium war, both then and now. But the British and Judaic bankers used Burma as a way to ship heroin into China. These are the same people, generations later, who will condemn the military government for doing the exact same thing. But I mentioned that the military here isn't very large. Burma has about 60 million people, but the full total membership of the Burmese army is under 400,000. They're about the size of Egypt. They're one of the lowest in terms of importing arms, actually 80th in the world. Maybe $20 million a year. Their military spending is just over 2% of GDP, far lower than the U.S. and elsewhere. 2.1% is about the same as Uganda, Portugal, or Finland. So you may have a military government, but it's hardly a militarized country. They only have about 2,500 tanks. however many work, I don't know. They have about 50 fighters from China in the Air Force. The Air Force has 15,000 men. So I'm not so sure how tyrannical a military government can be. And the military is largely based around anti-narcotic squads. So, under the most extreme circumstances, Burma has become a success. Economically speaking, of course, it's third world. But given the circumstances, they've developed their infrastructure admirably, despite the fact that the groups like the Shan Army and everything else will try to destroy it. Well, what about the military claim of voter fraud? The Union Solidarity and Development Party, which is one of the main military parties, contested the election in 310 townships. They say a total of just a bit over 1 million people were found to be voting in a fraudulent way. And, of course, one of the things that the Liberal government was claiming was that the COVID-19 outbreak meant that certain places had to vote in a very eccentric way. And that they claim that, you know, the 70% turnout was manipulated and altered because of the restrictions on movement. Just in Rangoon alone, you had 600,000 election aspects of election fraud. And not only do you have the military party saying this, you have local ethnic movements saying this. So one of the USDP volunteers, the headquarters, states this. He says, "In my township, there are 32,466 people with the exact same name, 32,466 people without the same name, 76 people aged over 100, with a total of 34,000 people. The fact that you have the exact same number of the exact same name, and those who seem to be the same person with a very different name as 32,466 is bizarre. All kinds of non-citizens voting. They say 496,000 did not have citizenship cards. You actually had to show citizenship in some way before you can vote. And that was regularly cast aside. You had 588,000 people substantially over the age of 100. And you still have these investigations starting from November. But this is roughly around the time, this happened on February 1st, where the new government was supposed to finally take over. Now, what makes it worthwhile to understand is that you have a massive amount of voter fraud claims compared to 2010. The problem is that the Union Election Commission is controlled by color revolutionaries. One of the things, I mean, this is something that the U.S. has spent a lot of money on, is that once they take over, once they install their people, and this goes, you know, Venezuela, Georgia, everywhere, they've already trained cadres to take over bureaucratic posts. This is something our people never seem to do. Unless they were the already functioning government, we don't have people who are willing to do this. When you hear about the U.S. democracy investments in these countries, having their seminars and college courses and everything else, this is what they're being trained to do. They're being trained not so much to be politicians, but they're being trained to take over administration. So the minute Aung San Suu Kyi was elected, or installed, I should say, 2011, 2012, one of the first things she did was staff these bureaucratic offices, especially the election offices, with her people. Now, in the 2010 election, you had 29 cases of election protests total. You had 45 cases in 2015. But in 2020, you have over 200 open, sometimes violent protests throughout the country challenging the election results. And the Union Election Commission is refusing to share information. They're refusing to even deal with this at all. The fact that these guys were willing to stare the military down and say, we're not going to do this, we're not going to give you documents, strongly suggests to me that they have Western backing, that they're doing this with a great level of confidence that which certainly doesn't make any sense otherwise. So what this comes down to is that Burma from 2012 and then specifically 2015 and 2020, you had color revolutionaries taking over the institutions of the state. The military remains very popular. This is typical for the Third World. Military is seen as the guarantor of law and order as these ethnic and drug-fueled groups attempt to take over, especially when it comes to the banking establishment. The army has not been affected very much by the liberal revolution. As I've said before, the problem is those institutions that would be investigating voter fraud. I guess it depends on who you read. You've had at least just in a few major towns, you've had a million specific complaints brought by citizens. I mean, just in the capital city, you have 200 actual suits being filed in one form or another. General Huang, who has taken over, told the Chinese that these are serious allegations that the Election Commission has refused to even deal with. They promised investigations and nothing ever happened. You have 200 townships where you have substantial uprisings, or at least substantial demonstrations. Those protest signs are not in English. The military bloc, the two major parties supporting the army and the National Socialist System, they called for a special parliamentary session. And the Union Parliament Office stated that because of COVID-19, we can't do it. Well, only 20 days were left before the new government takes over, and it would take 15 days to send out these invitations. In other words, they were doing everything they could to delay the procedure. Just like in the U.S., the regime is not defending the procedure. What gives it a certain level of authority is that even in the Shan state, the Tang National Party, for example, the Shan Nationalities League for Democracy, these at one time were supported by the color revolutionaries. These people have already filed suit against the election outcomes. So you have those at one time were supported by the regime now protesting this. You have a huge number of lawsuits, and they're dragging their feet. And it was just at the very end of January, February 1st, where the military finally stepped in. They were simply going to install this without any defense whatsoever. Just for another example, in the Arakan election in that state, you had 1.3 million out of over 1.6 million eligible voters that were not allowed to vote due to COVID-19 restrictions. Wherever military party was strong, local government, if they could, again, staffed by color revolutionaries, made sure to use COVID restrictions to keep them at home. But when you have the ethnic parties, I mean, they can't claim separatism, but they do exist, have stayed at least at one time were supported by the regime, claiming that marginalizes their ethnic representation. And because of the violence, especially in the South, ethnic parties are turning towards the military government and rejecting liberal domination of the country, knowing full well this was it wasn't always the case. It's sort of like Donald Trump polling very well amongst non-whites, which terrified the left. You had former constituents of the color revolutionaries moving towards the military system. You're seeing this everywhere. In other words, the point of it all is, again, there's a lot of translation problems here. I don't read the language or anything, but it's very clear that the system is not defending this election. They simply, again, told army officers, yeah, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. And nothing ever happened. I guess they were thinking that the new government will take over February 1st and they'll just forget about it. They didn't try to defend it. They just kept refiling paperwork, doing everything in their everything possible to keep any investigation. This is what happens when the color revolutionaries, trained by the United States, has an entire cadre, not just federally but locally, to take over government posts. As I said, the first thing that the color revolutionaries did, 2012, 2015, is make sure you have these Western-educated people. All these seminars that USAID were financing very quickly got government jobs. So not only do you have those who were financed by the color revolution taking over, a lot of them are English speakers. One of the things that the military did when they took over is confiscate the computers and documents from the Election Commission. The problem was the Election Commission refused to share information with either the military or the military parties. They absolutely refused to share documents. They demanded that the Election Commission give them the documents that they needed, and they were refused. They were, in fact, in the process of shredding them. This isn't unlike the U.S. This is why the coup took place. So, despite the technicalities of the vote, what's happening here is an attack on what we now know as the Belt and Road. And this is kind of the apogee of what we're doing here. Burma, of course, has been targeted for a long time because of the Chinese connection. Now, more specifically, the Strait of Malacca is extremely critical for Chinese shipping, especially for oil. If there's ever any war with Russia, a U.S.-dominated Burma, at least some of these states, like the Rakhine State, the U.S. would have to have taken over to block shipping. This is why the U.S. training these cadres to fill government posts, local government posts, are so essential. Even if they fail to take over the federal government, USAID is training people at the local level. The U.S. has attempted, even under the military regime, the U.S. has attempted to build naval bases on Burmese soil, offering them a fortune. You have three oil pipelines and one gas pipeline. One is under construction between Western Burma straight into China. It has a 12 million ton capacity for oil and gas. You have the exact same thing happening in Pakistan. You have the Center for International Policy, which is Open Society, George Soros institution, using and inventing an independent campaign, Baluchistan, all of a sudden came out of nowhere, creating this independence campaign of this little state, the point of which, of course, to dismantle the logistic corridor, blocking the influx from a Chinese seaport, so China, Burma, Pakistan. So Soros people have done this before. They'll invent a crisis. They'll invent something like the so-called Rohingya idea, the one happening in Sri Lanka, and there's one in Pakistan. Out of nowhere, this ethnic group will come into existence and demand independence. You have the Xinjiang in Western China. It's the same procedure. The corridors for the Silk Road Economic Belt. This is a multi-trillion dollar infrastructure project unifying the Eurasian plain. Russia and China are the main investors, China being the dominant one. And you even have Western countries like Germany heavily interested in this. The U.S. will place sanctions on anybody who even mentions investment in this project. It'll be a Eurasian system with state currencies, with full national independence, but a singular infrastructure under state-owned industries. It's no surprise that one of the big routes goes through Xinjiang, and it goes through Kazakhstan to Russia and Western Europe. And all these places where this particular belt goes through, the U.S. is building color revolutions. You have a southern route that also goes through Xinjiang to the Central Asian countries of Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. And it goes into Iran and Turkey and into southern Europe. You have the 21st century maritime Silk Road connecting China and Southeast Asia and connects them to Africa. Part of this is, of course, to diversify Chinese holdings and ability to trade, even under conditions of warfare. There's even one, the Polar Silk Road, added in 2018. There's probably nothing, economically speaking, in the planet more significant than this. The reason why we should be interested in it is that if liberalism is going to come crashing down, economically speaking, this is going to be the reason why. The multi-trillion dollar project here can't be challenged by the West. The West simply doesn't have the money. The West is bankrupt, both militarily, ideologically, and when it comes to finance. This is a state-centered, national idea that completely throws the Western bankers out in every way and explicitly rejects liberalism and the oligarchy as an ideological foundation. This is going to enshrine ethnic nationalism and the overall Eurasian ideological idea and give it its economic foundation. This is its economic backbone. International liberalism, of course, liberalism is international by definition, was financed in the post-World War II banking establishment. The representatives you see in the IMF, the World Bank, Davos, all this. The anti-liberal counter-revolution is in this new Silk Road. If you want to smash human trafficking, this is how it's going to be done. The U.S. is at war with it economically. And because Joe Biden, of course, is incapable of making any policy, you have people in his administration who can declare war and no one even know who they are. They'll stick Joe Biden's face on it. This is the economic confrontation here. Liberalism has an economic root. So does the anti-liberal movement. The anti-liberal movement, and it traverses several ideologies, but certainly superior to liberalism, which is our primary enemy, at least ideologically speaking, in global politics. Traverses a few of these, but they're united by the notion of ethnic nationalism, but unified economically to build their infrastructure. This is the anti-liberal international, for lack of a better word. And if you noted the places I mentioned where this corridor is traversing, we've covered on this show over the last few years every single area is deliberately the target of a color revolution. Therefore, it's not an exaggeration to say that most of the color revolutions, including what's going on right at this moment, are aimed at destroying this new Silk Road. And in the future, we'll talk more about that in particular. But that's what's happening in Burma. That's why it's important. And that's why you should pay attention. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.